This is our QA reading group, continuing our reading of Cybernetics and the Origin of Information. We're starting from page 79 of the translation. So we had just started chapter 4 last week. So yeah, so we're going through the concept of communication, which is sort of like the central example used in information theory, or the central like sort of paradigm case for information theory. And so like the earliest, the sort of technical information theory is also known as communication theory, and it was developed in relation with telephone communication and like at Bell Labs, so like a telephone company. So the idea is like you want to, you know, as a telephone company, you of course want to minimize how much you're spending on cables or wires to connect different phone customers. And but at the same time, if you reduce it too much, then the communication is like you have like unintelligible communication, and then you lose customers. So what is like the least amount of wire you can run between customers without sort of impairing communication? And so to be able to solve that problem, you have to have some sort of definition of like what it is that's being transmitted when you communicate from one end of a telephone line to the other. And so like the sort of simplest case is where you sort of break down the message into discrete symbols. So like an alphabet, it could be, you know, letters of the alphabet that, you know, as we normally understand them, or could like a simple case would be sort of a Morse code transmission. So you have like a dot and a dash, a short and a long signal. But in any case, like the communication process has to allow you to distinguish between possible messages as they arrive. So like you have to be able to tell the difference between a dot and a dash, for example, if you have a Morse code transmission coming in. If the noise in the channel is too high, then you can't tell whether there's a dot coming in or a dash, or, you know, whether there's even a message coming in at all. So you can sort of measure the amount of information in terms of how many potential messages are excluded by the actual message that comes in. So if the message is just a sort of binary choice, like on or off, or, you know, heads or tails or whatever, then you're, once you receive the message that the coin is heads, for example, you're excluding one other possible case that the coin was tails. And so this is what is represented as one bit of information. This is the sort of the simplest possible message. It's a binary choice. And then you can represent any other message in terms of how many binary choices are required to convey the information contained in that message. So like if you have letters of the alphabet, you have 26 letters, and then you would also probably want to have spaces and punctuation signs and so on. So you would have like a repertoire of symbols that you can transmit over this line, and then you would need a binary number, or sorry, like a power of two that is greater or equal than the number of symbols you want to transmit to be able to distinguish between all the possible symbols. So this concept of communication this notion of like the information content of a message as communicated across some sort of channel is completely agnostic or abstracts completely from the meaning or content or semantics of this message. So, you know, you can transmit, lines from a Shakespeare play, or whatever, you know, other important sort of literary communication, or you can just transmit a random sequence of, you know, letters and punctuation signs. And these two messages have the same information content. And in fact, actually, the sort of random sequence of characters actually has a higher information content, because with the like Shakespeare message or anything written in English or any other sort of normal written language, the different characters are not all equally probable, and different sequences of characters are not equally probable. And this is actually something that is used in like cryptography, for example, if you have a coded message, you can analyze the frequency of the different signs that are transmitted, and then you can sort of compare that to the frequency of signs in a corpus of English text or whatever language it is. And so, like, of course, we know the letter E is the most common letter in English text. And so if you analyze the frequencies of the symbols in your coded text, and you find, you know, one that has the highest frequency that sort of matches or is close to the frequency of the letter E in an English corpus, then you can guess maybe this symbol is the coded form of the letter E. And so you can sort of extract some information just from the differences in frequencies of the different letters. And then, of course, different letter combinations are more likely, or Q in English is almost always followed by U, except for a few loan words. And so on. Different sort of statistical properties of the message allow you to make predictions that are, beyond chance, right? Whereas if you just take a random sequence of symbols from the English alphabet plus punctuation signs, you can't predict anything from, from knowing one symbol what the next symbol is going to be. So this notion of communication as transmission of the information content of a message means that, the random sequence of symbols actually contains more information than a meaningful text. And this is kind of counterintuitive, and this is something that we talked about with Simon Dong as well, that he sort of criticizes this conception of information, and not to say that it's not sort of valid in for this particular technical use of figuring out how much cable you need to run to be able to transmit a message without distortion or interference. But in terms of the sort of criticism here is that when you take this sort of technical concept of information that is useful for this one purpose, and then you sort of extend it into the more, I guess, colloquial use of information as having to do with what is significant or valuable or important about a message, you're sort of, it's a kind of category error, and you are almost reversing what we normally mean by information, where, of course, we would consider, a sentence of comprehensible English to be more informative than a random sequence of characters, as opposed to less. So this is part of the criticism that Rieh is going to develop of this sort of communicational concept of information. But also, maybe more fundamentally, there's the question of where the information comes from in the first place. So in this sort of communication, technical sort of engineering conception of information, the origination of the message is sort of, it happens before you even sort of figure out how you're going to transmit the message. You just sort of presuppose that the message exists already at the transmitting end. And then the question is, how much cable or, what is the coding system that you need to transmit this message in an efficient way? So you don't even think about where does the message come from in the first place? And this is something that Rieh mentioned in the introduction of the book, is that it's sort of a fundamental principle of information theory, is that you can only ever, the transmission of a message can only ever preserve or reduce the information content of that message. So a channel, the best it can do is not diminish the information content of the message. So the message received would have exactly the same amount of information as the message transmitted. And then, of course, in practice, any information channel will contain a certain amount of noise and therefore will reduce the information content. And if this is the case, if every channel reduces the information content, even if only very minimally, then it seems like the amount of information available to be transmitted should be constantly decreasing, that there should be less and less information around in the world. So the question is, if this is the case, if we have this sort of constant degradation of information, then how do we originate a message in the first place? Where does the start of this chain, how does this chain start in the first place, to from which that degradation can happen? If all the processes that we know of are processes that degrade information, then how do we get a process that creates information to transmit in the first place? So this is sort of the fundamental question, I think, behind a lot of what he's describing in this chapter. But again, he's going through it in specific cases, different proposals that different cyberneticians have made for what what information would consist in. So that's sort of where we are now. We can dive into the text. If someone could read, I think we're at the heading Wiener's Myth, I believe.
I can read. Wiener's Myth. However, just as there are momentary self-alienations in the conscious being when he is seized by a mechanism he no longer controls, could there not be an alienation or inversion of the same type in Cajun? That is what Norbert Wiener claims in A Curious Predictive Myth. In place of two individuals telephoning messages to each other across the Atlantic, one can imagine, since material transport is only a particular case of communication, that one individual, quote-unquote, telephones himself with a machine. Thanks to communications via radio, television, and ultrafax, an architect who is in Europe can very well supervise the construction of a house in America by sending his instructions and plans to a constructor who reports back to him at every moment on the state of the work. He thus acts elsewhere than where he is materially. In this operation, the constructor plays the indispensable role of being a receiving center. Through communication, the architect transports his own ideas into the head of the constructor. Up to the present time, he needs this other head, which is conscious. But if everything is mechanical in communication, including the two quote-unquote endpoints, can't we conceive the possibility of a transport by communication, no longer only of the architect's instructions or plans, but of the architect himself? We send our voice by telephone, so why couldn't we send our larynx by a sophisticated telephone? In the mechanist hypothesis, the larynx and the entire organism are only a pattern, like the voice. Instead of taking a boat or a plane, the architect would, if we can put it this way, telegraph himself to America. An automatic reader would decode his organism in Europe, destroying him in the process, and a receiving apparatus, just as automatic, would make him appear in the new world. Thus, two consciousnesses would no longer be indispensable as contact points in communication. There would no longer be communicators, there would be pure communication. Wiener's myth is exactly the reverse of the mystical ideal. It is reverse and symmetrical. The duality of the communicators is resorbed in the mechanical instead of being resorbed in the mind. This myth is less absurd than it appears at first sight. Contemporary physics, particularly since the era of wave mechanics, effectively tends to efface the differences between material transport and communication. The majority of modern communication is done with waves, since the particles called material, as well as the corpuscles of light, electrons as well as photons, are inseparable from a series of waves. The myth of information transport has perhaps, therefore, like the alchemist's dream of making gold, already become reality on the microscopic scale. It is highly doubtful, however, that Louis de Broglie shows much enthusiasm for this fantastic, quote-unquote, consequence of wave mechanics. Without going as far as Wiener's myth, it is necessary to recognize that in certain cases, which are quite ordinary and common, a semi-alienation is produced in communication or transport. Instead of framing the subordinate transmission mechanisms with his consciousness, he can transform himself into an unconscious parcel. When I travel by sleeper train and I am asleep, I am hardly anything else. It is true that it was my own will that decided my transport before falling asleep during the journey. In a way, I receive myself in the station of arrival. An analogous but more striking case is that of being anesthetized for a surgical operation. The surgeon naturally asks the consent of the patient before the operation, but then the patient is treated like an inert corpse. If the patient has a cardiac arrest, and if the surgeon only resuscitates him by massage, he recovers himself on waking a little like he finds himself on the other side of the Atlantic after having traveled across it in wave form. In these latter cases, in reality, the principle of framing is not violated. Consciousness frames the voluntary suppression of consciousness during the spatial or temporal transport of the organism. Yeah, this is a, I guess Rouillet thinks that he's talked about kind of the identity of sense, which he places at the top of his, what he calls this pole of pure spirit in his kind of unhelpful diagram with the half sphere in the cylinder. And so it kind of seems like he thinks that, you know, in the same way that the sense of a message is identical in the mind of the person transmitting it and the mind of the person receiving it, the identity of a person teleporting by being decomposed and reconstructed on the other side of the Atlantic remains the same, even though the body is destroyed and recomposed. I don't know. It's an interesting point. I don't know if I agree with that. And he also doesn't explicitly say that. He just says that the principle of framing is not violated because consciousness is active on either end of the mechanical operation. But yeah, kind of a strange argument.
Yeah, I guess. So yeah, this sort of transportation thing is kind of funny. I don't remember what Wiener actually says about it, but I know that, so in the world of like Star Trek fandom, there are like all these people that sort of try to, you know, come up with explanations for how the technology is supposed to work. And of course, there's the transporter technology. And this is actually like precisely how some people have tried to, you know, explain this, is that it sort of like, you know, analyzes your, the, you know, molecules or atoms or whatever that compose your body, and just sort of transmits the information across, you know, this channel, and then sort of reconstitutes your body at the other end. Yeah, so I think the, I mean, yeah, so again, like I said, I don't remember exactly what Wiener said about this, but as far as I can gather from what Ruyer presents here, so Wiener, it seems to be sort of proposing that the role of the person at the end of, say, like a telephone communication, at both ends of the telephone communication, is sort of inessential, because you could, rather than having a communication between people where one person, where you have a person at each end, and the message passing between them, you can instead take the person themselves as the message. You could just, you know, transmit all the information that you've extracted from, you know, scanning all their, all the atoms in their body or whatever, and then reconstitute the person at the other end. So in this case, the person would be sort of, would be the message rather than the recipient or transmitter of the message. So Ruyer doesn't want to sort of completely reject this as a sort of absurd fantasy, although I think he does think it is a kind of fantasy. He describes it as a myth, of course. But he mentions that, you know, these other more sort of banal cases, like, you know, you get on the train at night, you go to sleep, and you wake up in, you know, a different country hundreds of kilometers away. You've sort of, in a sense, like transmitted yourself across, you know, a certain distance, that, you know, in between your decision to get on the train and then falling asleep and then waking up the next day, you've sort of appeared in a different location. So this is sort of analogous to the, you know, Star Trek transportation device, except for the fact that it's not not instantaneous. It, you know, takes time, and of course the fact that you're, you know, asleep during this operation. And then likewise, you know, this you know, surgery where you undergo anesthesis, so you are likewise sort of transmitting yourself, in this case not across distance but across time, where you sort of at the outset you agree to be anesthetized, you sort of suspend your existence for a certain amount of time, and then you receive yourself at the end of that time when you wake up, and so it's again a kind of almost a sort of transportation of yourself across a time interval. So these are like more sort of banal and less, you know, fictional examples of this kind of like treating yourself as a message, transporting yourself across, you know, space and or time. But what Ruyer is insisting on here is that in all these cases, it's you still haven't sort of gotten away from the need for this framing effect of consciousness, the role of, a person in sort of setting up this transmission in the first place. So like when you get on the train, you as a person making a decision are still the one who gets on the train, you know, lies down in bed, whatever, and then wakes up at the end and, you know, receives the transmission of yourself, if you want to put it in those terms. So even though it's not entirely wrong to sort of treat this as like a transmission of oneself across, you know, this space-time distance, at the same time, the sender and recipient of this transmission are you as a person, and so you're not really getting away from the fact that you have a person at each end of this chain. And so even if you suppose this, like, you know, science fiction Star Trek transporter device that, you know, instantaneously transmits a person across distance, you know, by scanning the atoms or whatever, you still, in this case, would have the framing of the conscious person, you know, stepping on to the transporter pad or pressing the button to transport the person or whatever. You still haven't, like, eliminated the role of the person in this framing of the operation. And I think that's what Rie wants to insist on here. Even if we sort of, even if we grant that this science fiction device is possible, we still don't eliminate the role of the person as, you know, framing the chain that sets up this transportation operation. Just a slight aside, but on the anesthesia example here, like, so maybe like 10 years ago, I think I had a minor eye operation that required anesthesia. So I was out for like a couple hours. And, you know, as I was like, you know, sort of in the hospital, like preparing for this operation, I was just thinking about like what a bizarre sort of experience this is, where like you're like, I had met the doctor once beforehand for like 15 minutes or whatever. So I'm sort of like trusting this person I've barely met to like inject my body with poison that essentially turns my body off for a certain amount of time. And like, you know, with the assumption that this person is going to control the dosage and so on and keep me hooked up to machines that make me breathe and that I will wake up afterwards. Like it's a very, like when you think about all the sort of like institutional practices that have to go into making this something that you would like agree to do it's very strange. It's a very strange experience if for anyone who has gone through that. And yeah, and like Bat said, it's very strange, where it's sort of like anticlimactic, where you have this, you know, you can't eat beforehand, like usually at like 12 hours or something. And like there's all this, you know, build up and you sign all these forms and whatever. And then the actual sort of like center of the operation, like the actual surgical operation itself, is like something you don't even experience. You just wake up afterwards. So it's like, it's as if you like go to see a play and you like have all the build up and, you know, audience is sitting there and whatever. And then the play actually happens like, you know, behind the curtain, and then the curtains open, and then the actors like, you know, bow and whatever, and you don't actually see the play itself. It's a very strange sort of, yeah, experience to go through. I think also this section is like a sort of a perfect like encapsulation of Rie's style, where he takes this like, you know, sort of like fantasy science fiction thing, and then he like makes this like seemingly pretty like a very unexpected connection with like these, you know, banal things like falling asleep on a train. But then you, as you sort of think about it, you go, yeah, that actually sort of, you know, makes sense. And then like, yeah. And then sort of analyzing, you know, what the like lesson you can draw from this experience is in this unexpected way. I think, yeah, it's this very interesting sort of approach to like, on the one hand, it's very sort of concrete in that he's like pointing to these, you know, everyday kind of phenomena that, you know, I mean, anesthesia is not necessarily everyday, but it's not a rare occurrence in people's lives. But then he just sort of like shines this unexpected light on it, and, you know, connects it to other things that you would never really like sort of think of connecting it to. It's just a very, yeah, I mean, we don't get anything about the souls of electrons in this bit, but this is like his typical thing where yeah, you start from something that seems like very straightforward, and you go, oh yeah, that makes sense. And then, yeah, you get this like fairly bizarre sort of metaphysical, like abstract position. And then he, you know, connects them together in a way that you would never have, you know, expected. And yeah, so it's kind of entertaining in a way that a lot of other philosophers are not, where like, yeah, you can, even if you maybe don't necessarily find it that convincing, you're still like entertained by, you know, sort of considering this idea and this connection between, you know, this metaphysical position and sort of depiction of an everyday situation, or maybe an analysis of a scientific theory, etc. Yeah, and yeah, exactly as Bat said here, that's like this treating science fiction stories as a thought experiment. So it's not just like, I mean, obviously there's lots of, you know, science fiction stuff that is not necessarily that intellectually stimulating, but there's also, yeah, science fiction things that are, you know, sort of important, that have like a philosophical value, that they, you know, they're sort of treating problems about, say, like personal identity, you know, what it is to be a person and to be the same person as at one time and a different time, or the nature of the mind or knowledge, etc. Like I'm thinking of, you know, Philip K. Dick stories about like, you know, what is it to know anything about the world, or like, you know, the sort of like a skeptical, you know, a sort of like existential depiction of skepticism, and not just as a sort of philosophical problem that you would write papers about. Yeah, so like treating these stories as as a thought experiment and as something to sort of extract a philosophical lesson from, or to try to as like experiments to try out different philosophical concepts on, I think is a pretty cool methodology that maybe not as many philosophers use as they should. It's a neat little approach to problems that like I think the thought experiments that you find in philosophy papers tend to be pretty trivial a lot of the time. Like, you know, obviously the trolley problem has become like a meme now because of its sort of absurdity. But when you look at like, you know, stories that are I mean they're not primarily written as like examples to be used in philosophy papers. They're written for something like entertainment, whatever exactly that means, but also as a kind of exploration of these concepts. But precisely because they have like more concreteness or like a richer content to them than this sort of absurd, you know, trolley problem type thought experiment, I think it gives you more to think about than sometimes the like fairly silly thought experiments that are presented in philosophy papers. So I'm noticing that we are at a chapter break. We've only had a fairly short session so far. I'm wondering, do we want to stop here and pick up the chapter at the beginning of the chapter next time, or read the first couple pages of this chapter?
Depending on how much time you all have, I wouldn't mind reading a couple pages, but you know, if you all are in a rush, I also totally fine with me early.
Yeah, I can stay for another 25 minutes. So let's see if there's a section break in there's no section break in the first few pages. But yeah, we can read a few pages. For Null, we're at chapter 5, page 81 of the translation. So I can read the first couple pages of the chapter, and then we'll discuss. Okay, so chapter 5, The Origin of Information. R.A. Fisher, Claude Shannon, and Norbert Wiener were the first to define the notion of the quantity of information with precision. As we have seen, basic information is the alternative yes, no, or any other quote-unquote binary decision. One or zero, right or left, and so forth. This is the unit of information, or quote-unquote Hartley. If we have to localize a point on a line or describe a given figure with perfect precision, the quantity of information must be infinite. Practically, a description, a localization, or a measure are never perfect. Let's consider a point P, which we simply know is situated on some part of a line between A and B. We are then informed by 0 signifying the left half, or by 1 signifying the right half, that it is in the left half, then in the right half of this left half, and so on. The binary number in the form 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, which expresses our information, can never be an indefinite series of 1s and 0s. Information has a limited precision. It only gives a zone of probability AB between A and B. Here, for example, the fifth digit after the comma is undetermined. The quantity of information is limited to 4 digits after the comma. The quantity of information gained by the passage from big AB to small AB amounts to a logarithm of a probability. The formula that expresses it is exactly the formula for entropy, which is also a logarithm of a probability, but with the opposite sign. Information is a negative entropy. This result was surprising and even seemed quote-unquote sensational. It is, however, only natural and is easy to understand. Suppose that the line AB represents a metal bar at a certain uniform temperature. We raise the temperature of zone little AB. The second law of thermodynamics implies that the temperatures soon equalize themselves and become uniform again. The entropy of the system increases. While in the previous example, the information about the location of point P between big A and big B increased as the zone little AB was narrowed, in the case of the heated bar, on the contrary, the entropy increases as the temperatures equalize and the zone little AB merges with the whole big AB. The increase of entropy is then equivalent to a decrease of information, and vice versa. Once again, there is nothing extraordinary in this, since information is synonymous with structure or organization, and entropy synonymous with disorganization. As long as the zone little AB is at a higher temperature than the rest of the bar as a whole has a certain degree of structure. It is, quote-unquote, informed in the etymological sense of the word, and therefore, as an observer, I am informed, in the ordinary sense of the word, that a particular event has occurred in little AB. When entropy has become maximal, the thermal agitation is homogeneous throughout the bar and information is minimal. The zones of probability, previously distinct, are fused. If I write with bad chalk on a bad slate, the rapid homogenization of the chalk dust over the entire surface of the slate is a phenomenon analogous to an increase in entropy at the same time, and at the same time, a loss of information. The written words become illegible. If the quote-unquote static on the telephone or the radio reaches a certain intensity, or if the modulations are too weak and descend to a level of fluctuation that causes static, the speech becomes indistinct. That being said, since any machine, no matter how sophisticated, including calculating machines or feedback automata, can only increase entropy as they operate according to the principles of thermodynamics, it is evident that they can only decrease information. The background noise in the telephone or the radio can scramble the message, but it is impossible to imagine that the pure chance of the fluctuations can reconstitute a message that has been scrambled or create information out of nothing. It is as impossible or as improbable as a kettle freezing when put on to boil. Entropy goes in the direction of the most probable states. Information, which has the opposite sign, is therefore an anti-probability, or to use an old expression of Arthur Eddington's, quote-unquote, anti-chance. Chance cannot account for anti-chance. The mechanical communication of information by a machine cannot account for information itself, since the machine can only degrade it, or at best preserve it. Cybernetics cannot escape the contradiction. If, quote, no operation by a machine on a message can gain information, unquote, and if, on the other hand, quote, there is no reason why the essential mode of functioning of the living organism should not be the same as that of the automaton, unquote, then where does information come from? I'll stop here. So this is what I was talking about in the intro bit about this question or this sort of paradox in the theory of information, where if you try to extend the sort of engineering technical definition of information to a more colloquial use of the term information and try to treat living beings as equivalent or operating on the same principles as machines that transmit information, then you end up with a sort of inexplicable origin of information. You can't understand how processes that degrade information or reduce the quantity of information could be the origin or the source of the information in the first place. And this bit about temperature, before I go on to that, I'll mention, he talks about like localizing a point on a line, and this is actually something that is maybe like in sort of your first year stats class, like that can sometimes be confusing for students, where you start with like a discrete set and you analyze probability of events in your discrete set. So you have a set of discrete events and you assign a probability to them, and they have to fit certain axioms, they have to sum to one, so on. But you can assign a probability to a single event in this set. But when you move on to continuous probability, like a real line, your set that you're assigning probabilities to is the real line, you can't actually assign a probability to a single point on this line. So the sort of like illustration of this, it's obviously not a sort of proof or anything like that, but the illustration is like you imagine throwing darts at a line segment. The probability of the dart, and here the dart is imagined as having a point with zero width. So the probability of that dart hitting any given point on the line is zero. You can only assign probabilities to intervals on the line. So you can say that the dart will strike between points A and B on this line segment with probability X, but you can't say the line will, or the dart will strike this precise point on the line with probability X. It's a little bit tricky and maybe confusing that like the line is supposed to be made up of points, but there's a probability for any given line segment of striking within that interval, but you can't actually assign a probability to striking a given point on that line. Of course, in like any real application, so if you're talking about a real dart on a real, I shouldn't use the word real here because it has a mathematical term, but like if you talk about a physical, line or, a dartboard or whatever, and a physical dart, you can only measure, the place where the dart strikes the dartboard up to a certain degree of precision. You have like, a micrometer or whatever, you have some sort of device to measure the distance from the edge of the dartboard to where the dart is sort of inserted into the dartboard. But you can only measure up to a certain degree of accuracy. That, like, say you measure up to, you know, 1/10 of a millimeter or whatever. It means that you have like an interval of you know, surrounding that point, or you have an interval within which the dart is located, but you can't specify beyond the smallest the smallest unit of measurement that you can measure with your device. And this is true for any type of measurement. Even when you talk about, like, you know, atomic clocks or whatever, these sort of hyper precise instruments used in, like, you know particle physics or whatever, you still have a sort of margin of error, or a certain limited degree of accuracy, even if it's extremely, you know, you have like 7 decimal points or whatever, you're still only specifying a time or a distance or whatever it is within a certain interval, as opposed to a precise number. Like, you can never measure something to be exactly pi or exactly square root of 2, or even exactly 2 for that matter. You can only say it's within a certain interval of 2. It's 2 plus or minus whatever. So yeah, it's and then this, of course, raises the question of what exactly do we mean when we say that, like, these continuous, you know, the continuum, the real line, for example, sort of underlies that we think of that as, like, more fundamental, and then the intervals as being sort of on the real line. Like, if we can only ever measure something as being within a certain interval, then in what sense is that real line, you know, real in a more, I guess, physical sense of that term? It's a kind of strange problem where, like, the thing that we think of as the most fundamental sort of basis for measurement is actually something we can never measure. Oh yeah. So in connection with, yeah, so Angus has asked, is it because of the decimal expansion? So yeah, like, that's a sort of reflection of this problem that, like, so any measurement of a quantity is always going to have a finite number of significant figures, or, like, you know, points after the decimal that numbers after the decimal point that reflect the measurement. So yeah, if you have something that can measure like a length down to the millimeter, then, you know, anything, any decimal, any figures past the millimeter length are meaningless, or they don't convey any information in that sense. So all you know is that the length is X plus or minus 1 millimeter, plus or minus less than 1 millimeter. So you can't actually specify it down to, so if you were to give a real number precision, like you say that this, I don't know, metal bar is exactly square root of 2 meters long, you would need an infinite number of decimal points, an infinite number of significant figures in your measurement. And of course, any measurement has only finite precision. So conveying a length or whatever other measured quantity in like infinite precision would actually convey an infinite amount of information. And so, like, a point on the real line, specifying a single point on a real line would require an infinite amount of information, which again seems sort of counterintuitive, where we think of that, like, you think that, like, an interval would be bigger in some sense than a point, right? It would, so it, therefore you would think it might require more information to transmit, you know, to specify an interval than it would to specify a point. But it's actually the opposite, because you can, as Kriya described here, you can specify an interval just by dividing the line segment in half, and then specifying which half of that initial half the interval is in, etc. And you can, in a finite number of steps, you can specify the interval in terms of left half versus right half, or, you know, whatever other, you can come up with other procedures as well. But, like, yeah, it only takes a finite amount of information to specify where on a line segment a certain interval is located, whereas to specify one exact point, you know, a real number, you would need an infinite number of decisions between left and right half, or whatever other number, whatever other procedure you have to specify that point. Yeah, so this is, you know, slightly, it's not really the point of this section, but this is, you know, connected to the whole, you know, labyrinth of the continuum. You know, in Leibniz's term, this whole idea that, like, there's something about a continuous line or the continuum, the concept of a continuum, that is sort of this, like, there's something that sort of surpasses even what we think of as a countable infinity. So, like, the rational numbers, for example, you know, like fractions as we learn about them in school. They are countable. Cantor showed that you can set up a one-to-one correspondence between rational numbers and natural numbers. So you can say, like, this is the first fraction, this is the second fraction. It's a little bit, you have to come up with a bit of a clever procedure to make sure you don't miss any, but it is possible. So there are, in the sense of set theory, they're the same quantity, or the same, the set of rational numbers has the same size as the set of, cardinality, exactly. Has the same size as the set of natural numbers. And so it seems as if there should be more, in terms of just a sort of intuitive conception, it seems like there should be more fractions or more rational numbers than natural numbers. But that turns out not to be the case. But then, and especially when you think about, rational numbers have the property known as density. So between any two rational numbers, you can always find a third rational number. So it's greater than the smaller of the two and smaller than the larger of the two. So if you take like 1/2 and 1/3, you can find 3/5 or whatever. You can pick any rational number between those two. And so, of course, once you find that third one, you can pick that one and another number and find another number between those two, etc. So you can keep sort of descending to smaller and smaller intervals. But even that sort of never-ending process of, finding a new rational number between any pair of rational numbers, even that is still not enough to get you to the sort of precision or the degree of depth that you would need to go to get to the continuum. It's a very tricky and complicated problem of like how to grasp something like the continuum, that we know sort of goes beyond what you can grasp even through this never-ending process of dividing a line and dividing the results again and so on. Yeah, maybe one day we can do a whole reading group on like continuity, the concept of the continuum and so on. That would be fun. Because it's like, yeah, there's all kinds of, yeah, of course, this is a little bit of a lot of a tangent, sorry, but of course you have Newton and Leibniz in the 17th century independently come up with the procedures that are part of calculus or analysis today, where you're dealing with things like a tangent is just the first derivative. So yeah, we're just doing calculus on concepts. So they come up with the procedures of calculus, but at the same time they, like, when they sort of explain what they're doing or why this is a valid procedure, they are using these concepts, like especially Leibniz uses these concepts of like an infinitesimal, and he describes it as smaller than any assignable quantity, which is a little bit hard to understand. And especially some of the things that he does in like manipulating these concepts are kind of dubious, where he'll like use this infinitesimal as if it were a number. Like he'll divide something by this infinitesimal dx, and then at the end of the whole operation he'll like set dx to zero because it's infinitesimal, so it's smaller than anything, so you can just neglect it. But then of course if it was equal to zero, then you couldn't have divided by it before. So it's not clear that what you're doing is actually like correct and is not going to lead to contradictions. But at the same time, it turns out to be very useful to proving already known results and also finding new results, and especially in physics, of course. So there's like hundreds of years of like this state of like, we have this discipline that is extremely important to mathematics that we don't really understand why it works, or like whether there's limits on the domains in which it works, etc. And then various ways of sort of explicating the concepts behind the concept of so like the sort of more traditional one is in terms of limits, and then there's various attempts in the 20th century to revive the concept of an infinitesimal, more or less the way Leibniz did it, but with like more, I guess, clarity, that was sort of having a better understanding of what it is exactly that we're doing when we operate with infinitesimals. So it's very interesting to sort of look at these different approaches and try to understand what exactly. Non-standard analysis, for example, is one of these attempts where it sort of arises out of model theory. So like, if you can present a model for a theory where you have real numbers and infinitesimals, so you have quantities that are less than any real number, but different from zero, then yeah, so you produce a model for it to show that this is actually consistent. That's sort of like where non-standard analysis comes from. But you can also just use it as like a, basically once you sort of show that this is consistent, you can just sort of operate with the concept of infinitesimals as like a sort of notion that you just use practically without needing really to understand the model theoretic, you know, proof that this is consistent. But yeah, it's a, and then there's like approaches to non-standard analysis where you use an alternative set theory, for example. It's a very interesting sort of domain of research that I don't know as much about as I would like, but it's something I'm trying to learn more about. Yeah, another, I've taken us on this detour here, but yeah, so another, a book. So if you, yeah, read the Stanford article, if I remember correctly, the author is John Bell, who also has a book on the concept of the infinitesimal, which is, it's not non-standard analysis. It's a different approach that comes out of category theory called smooth differential geometry or synthetic differential geometry. That would be another one to look at once you read the Stanford article. There's like all these different approaches, and what exactly the relationship is between them is something I don't know that well, like which ones can prove different things and which ones have sort of stronger or weaker strength in terms of what they can prove. Some of these involve like very sort of abstract, like sort of sheaf theory concepts and so on that I don't know a lot about. I definitely need to build up a lot of the prerequisites before I can have a good grasp of what's going on in these different domains.
Yeah, same here. I find this stuff super interesting, and you know, it's obviously relevant to at least, you know, Bergson, Whitehead, Deleuze, and I think in his criticisms of actualism and presentism, perhaps Rouillet as well, but I'm not familiar with his writings on embryogenesis yet.
Yeah, there's a book, I forget who the author is, there's a book on Bergson and calculus. I haven't read it, but that's sort of like the core of Bergson's work, is like the relationship between this continuous duration and the sort of discrete quantities that we find in the, you know, measurable world, how to understand this, you know, becoming as this continuum in relation to, you know, the actual. It's a kind of like hidden thread throughout like 20th century philosophy, is this like relationship between the continuous and the discrete.
Yeah, that's interesting. If you remember the author of that book, I would appreciate it if you send it to me.
Yeah, I'll look it up. I'm pretty sure I can find it in the library catalog, and I'll send it to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry. That sort of detour took us, I think, to the end of my time for today, unfortunately. We can pick up next time. In terms of scheduling, I should mention, yeah, so I'm going to be traveling the next 2 weekends, and so I won't be able to meet for 2 weeks, but then the week after that we can pick up again as usual.
That sounds good. It was a bit of a detour, but a very interesting one.
Cool. Yeah, so everyone can read up on differential geometry in the next couple weeks and then come back and explain it to us. So thanks everyone for coming out. Sorry we had to do a bit of a shorter session today, and so we'll come back in 3 weeks to pick up on where we stopped today.
That sounds good. Thanks, Nan. Thanks, everyone.